Sunday afternoon, 27th May 1973. Let us look a little more closely at the Upanishadic presentation of the moralities involved in the religious life, as formulated particularly in the Shandilya Upanishad, when Shandilya asks his teacher Atharvan to expound to him the 8 limbs of yoga. And the first, of course, is the yamas, as they are called, the moralities. Then come the niyamas, the religious observances. Then posture and breathing, and then the other 4, which deal with meditation in all its aspects, culminating in samadhi, which is the complete and perfect communion. Let us look into these yamas. Yama is translated as forbearance, the forbearances. It has also been translated very interestingly as mortification. Now, a word about this mortification. It must be clearly understood that in yoga and in all its discipline, which appears to be very ascetic in some ways, there is not the slightest idea of hurting or destroying the body, or suppressing the psychical life in any aspect. It's very important to understand this. Then what is the meaning of mortification in this context? To mortify means to bring to death. Mors mortis, death. To bring to death. But the death of what? The death of all that obstructs and is a hindrance to the living of the religious life. But does this death, bringing to death, mean a conflict, an antagonism to whatever one sees as obstructing the religious life? No, it is not that. It is a case of such complete understanding of the real nature of that which obstructs the religious life, that one is no longer interested in letting it be part of one's life. That which obstructs the religious life is present because we ourselves are responsible for it, at least partly responsible. Our environment may be partly responsible. But if we don't give it entry and shelter and nourish it, that which obstructs the religious life wouldn't be there. Now, this is, of course, largely due to our own ignorance of what actually does obstruct the religious life. But as if we are truly interested, if we truly care for this, which is the most worthwhile thing in the world to care about, and we begin to see by our own inner vision and insight that this definitely obstructs us, when we see that, we have lost all interest in it, and it just drops out of our life. No longer interested in it. You know how it is in ordinary life. A man meets another man in the street and says, Hello, Jim. Why haven't you been coming to the club for the last 3 or 4 years? We've missed you. Oh, well, I've lost interest. That's all. He's no longer interested in it. Therefore, he has ceased to go to the club. Simple as that. When I've ceased to hold on to my weaknesses, my flaws, my vices, my absurdities, they just drop off. Like a scab which has formed on the skin. And when the skin is again quite healthy, the skin has no more interest in displaying a scab, and the scab falls off. And that's all there is to it. So, it's mortification in that sense. It requires understanding. What we have really understood, really seen through, has been done with. Now, let us see what Atharvan puts before Shandilya. There are 10 yamas which he stresses. 10, if you like to call them so, virtues. First and foremost comes harmlessness. Ahimsa, harmlessness. Then comes truthfulness. Do remember, this order is not necessarily in order of importance. This is how it is put. Truthfulness. Then comes non-covetousness. And then, I'll give you the Sanskrit word first, brahmacharya, which is usually translated, I think, unfortunately, as total abstention from sexual relations. Now, I think it is a mistake to translate brahmacharya solely as abstinence from sexual relations. Brahmacharya literally means a walking in Brahma, a walking in God. That is what it means. If you don't like the word God, the ultimate real, in reality, in truth, use any word you like. It means so living, and all life is movement, so living that it is God-like living. It is as perfect living as one can possibly express in everyday life. This is brahmacharya. Now, if this is to be the case, then all our energies must of necessity not be squandered in anything and everything which contravenes this walking in God. Mustn't it? That means a containment of our energies. In one word, continence. Now it is for each individual to see for himself and decide what this continence means. If all the energies are carefully contained, not squandered, where and how will they express themselves? The capacity to be continent means that seeing this, that and the other is a squandering of energy, one also sees, therefore, precisely what is not a squandering of energy and what is a right use of energy. Our psychophysical energy, our mental, our intellectual, our aesthetic, every aspect of us, our spiritual energies, whatever they are. And therefore, that life is the continent life. It is the pure life in the true sense of the word. This India has always, I think, slightly overbalanced on this business of total abstention from all sexual expression. In most cases, with somewhat unhappy results. There are only a few who can really come to that stage where they have developed and grown so harmoniously, healthily, beautifully, that the sexual expression of their energies just naturally doesn't exist. There is no need for it. They are free of it altogether. Yesterday, I think it was, that I spoke about Shakti, energy, power, in the yogic, in the Kundalini yoga symbolism, and it is a symbolism, remember. It is associated with the psychophysical energy, particularly the psychical energies, which are held in the reservoir which is at the base of the spine. And Shakti is taken up by the yogi till she unites herself with her Lord Shiva at the top. You see, transcendence is realized. That means that one's entire psychophysical energy is so utilized, so expressed in life, that one's whole life has become the divinized, the deified life. That's what it means in actual fact and practice. See? Well, now that, in that state, this energy, which found its basic expression in terms of sexual and procreative activity, is now entirely utilized in transcendental, spiritual, intellectual, intelligent ways. That is all. But if you rigidly say to yourself, out with sex, without understanding the why, the how, and come to it naturally, then of course there is trouble. In every case there is trouble. You find the miserably repressed celibate as a fairly obvious phenomenon in some parts of the world, including our own too. You also find the person who has flowered into the natural celibate. When one has flowered into natural celibacy, the male and female aspects of our own being, our psychophysical being, are in perfect harmony, as well as the transcendent male-female in our own being is now in perfect harmony. To put it in Kabbalistic terms, Yahweh is once again in union with his Shekinah, his glory, his manifestation, which is the feminine aspect. Or the Ancient of Days, with, he is called the king, with Matrona, the ever-virgin mother. These are symbolistic ways of talking. But if the mind sort of penetrates into the reality underlying the symbol, then there is freedom. Real inward freedom comes into being. And as I said either yesterday or the day before, there is no such thing as a sex conflict or problem for that person. You will see, obviously, that this is something which is a case of growth in time. Because whilst the psychophysical energies in our young years, and our young years run into 40 and 50 almost, you see, the psychophysical energy in our young years is primarily, gives the primary blind urge towards procreative activity. We are caught by the powers of nature, so to say. The world must go on. Life must go on. Mankind must go on. And the tremendous pleasure drive involved in it holds us captive. It's almost impossible for a young person to see into this with insight. He can certainly see into it intellectually. When I was a little boy, I saw into it intellectually, but nothing doing, my lad. You see, it's like that. So you must be patient with yourself. If you're impatient with yourself, you're hating yourself. You put yourself in a state of conflict. And in the state of conflict, there is no possibility of continence. No possibility of simple, natural, spontaneous purity. This is very important. We must realize this. See, Krishnamurti gives a golden key towards the practical approach to these problems, whatever one's age. Neither indulge any urge or desire which comes up, nor fight against it, but be totally observant of it. One may say, well, how can one be so totally observant? You're caught up in the urge. I feel this, I desire this, I need this, and so forth. Perhaps the secret is here. When observing, we observe as I, the subject, observing. If that which is observed is related to I, the subject, one cannot escape the tangle. One cannot be free of the bond, the bondage there. The observation which will inevitably start with I, the subject, looking at it and therefore relating that whole complex to me, the person, gradually there is released the power to see the complex in itself as a complete and total situation in which, as a matter of course, one's own living organism is involved. But it is because you don't see it as I, the subject, and call it my problem, you see it as a whole fact, complete in itself. And when you see the whole fact complete in itself, this self-association and this being bound to the problem is out of the situation. This is true, quite true. This is how it works. And then comes freedom. There is then not comes freedom, but one is in the state of freedom. You see, Beryl was pointing out the other day when we were discussing that, see, this is fear or this is anger. Yes. But you see, whilst we may intellectually say to ourselves, right, I am going to observe that way, this is fear, this is anger. But remember that in the unconscious part, this tendency, this enormous force which makes us see everything as related to ourselves is so great that we deceive ourselves intellectually into believing that we are looking at it dispassionately. We are not, in actual fact. We believe we are. But you can't, all of us, look at things not dispassionately, not with true detachment. We imagine that, now that I know this with the brain, I'm from the next minute onwards going to look at it dispassionately, but I haven't got the capacity. You see, let us look at it this way. I'm playing a piece of music, say on the piano. Right? It's not quite right. I know that it isn't quite right. It isn't coming off as it should. My teacher sits down and plays it perfectly. And I say, that's how it should be played. Do you think I can play it? I can't. Its capacity, ability, grows with time. When one is told, and not unjustifiably, that you can be free immediately, in the now, do remember that that happens only after one has reached the culmination of accumulated effort through time, and then on the one critical, wonderful occasion, the last straw, so to say, and lo and behold, the thing is done forever. You can't do it all at once like that. No one can. I don't think anybody can. But once having reached that inward maturity, that inward state of purity and harmony in the psyche, then the inner powers which are lying within the depths of the mind have all come into activity and into right activity, and they are with you now. Now you can do what the novice, the beginner, the earnest aspirant cannot do. It's very important to realize this. If one sees it clearly with the mind, one will see that it is just as, I'm just going to use the commoner garden word, it is just as sinful to hurt oneself as to hurt anybody else. It is, well, let me put aside sinful. It is just as absurd to hurt oneself as to hurt anybody else. It takes infinite patience and love to tend this somewhat unhappy plant now, mankind, on the globe. Infinite patience and love. All right, so much for continence. Truthfulness, you understand. Harmlessness, you understand. Non-covetousness. This is difficult. Take simple examples. I'm walking along. Oh, that's a nice house. It is not a totally dispassionate, pure aesthetic judgment. That's a beautiful house. If I am able to be that much alert and awake, inside me is the desire to have it. I'd like it. I want it. You watch. Whatsoever we see, touch, taste, etc., you will always find this grasping if the response is something I like. One is the slave of one's likes and of the pleasure drive. When the pleasure drive operates after the sense stimulus comes to us, this poor brain and mind completely forget that the pleasure drive is actually the pleasure-pain drive. Everlastingly, it is the pleasure-pain drive. The pleasure drive can never lead us to pure joy. This pleasure drive is one which fulfills itself in terms of sensational excitement and satisfaction of the sensational, nature. But when that satisfaction is over, the craving is not past at all. You want more of it. Very few human beings ever outgrow the greedy, guzzling stage of the child. You give a child something which it likes, oh, I want some more, I want some more, till it nicely balloons out with what it wants more and then gets such a tremendous bellyache that it doesn't know what to do with itself. Then come the tears and the pain. But this is how it is. We think that because we are now 20 years old, oh, we've passed all that, put it behind us, you know, and when we are 40, we look down upon the young ones, forgetting that we are just the same in other forms. Oh, I'll buy up that business. Oh, I'll get hold of that garage, etc., etc. I'll do this, I'll do the other. I will become Secretary of State, Prime Minister. Non-covetousness. You see the enormous implications? And say, when we say, oh no, but I am no longer interested in worldly things, I am only interested in spiritual things. I am interested in the religious life. I am going to be the holy man, the holiest of the holy men, holier than thou. It is there at behind us. Because whatever is desired must have the drive of ambition or jealousy or whatever it is at the back of it. This is the peculiar thing about our human nature. When there is pure vision, you have seen the fact as the fact in its wholeness, without I, the subject, being involved in it, then there is freedom and perfection. You see, one consequence of the freedom from I, the subject, being involved in it. When I'm free of that involvement as a subject, the object also has disappeared. Now the point is this. Here is an object. Here is me. If the isolative consciousness of I, the subjective, is out, I, the subject, is out, then the isolative consciousness of that, the object, is also out. How are you aware then? Then you are aware and conscious in terms of wholeness, of completeness. That's the culmination, the complete fruition of man and his awareness, his consciousness. Now you are aware as man was intended to be aware, in terms of the whole, the totality. If there is no I, there is also no separate you. There is only the wholeness then. You know, these are things which, if realized very deeply, become second nature to us. We are always aware in that whole sense. And if we are aware in that whole sense, if we are also harmless, truthful, continent, all the world is included. This is love. This is the real meaning of love in its transcendence. And this is the real meaning of that awareness of wholeness which is pure wisdom. Because then no question arises of, oh, this or that. To use Krishnamurti's phrase, choiceless awareness is present. Choiceless awareness means non-separative and not separating awareness. In the awareness of the whole, what will you attempt to throw out? We are naturally aware of the body as a whole. We don't try to throw out any bit of the body. Supposing I didn't like my nose because it is curved like this at the end, you see? Do I catch hold of it and throw it out? How absurd. So now, we have touched upon four of the aspects of the yamas. Then, daya, the Sanskrit word. I don't know why, it's a personal idiosyncrasy. I've always liked that word, daya. And the English word, which for me is the nearest, the perfect equivalent to daya, is the word ruth. Ruth. Kindliness. A ruthless person is a pitiless person, isn't he? But daya is ruth. You get it? That sort of kindliness. The ordinary sense of kindliness which we have and which we express in the world is not quite that which the word ruth expresses. So it seems to me. I mean, it may be different for you. Kindliness is daya. Kindliness or ruth is daya. Oh, your name is... Then we have equanimity. And then patient endurance. Patient endurance. That's how it is translated. You can also regard it as enduring patience. Patience which is always there. You know how the Buddha says, patience and forbearance are the supreme austerity. Patience and forbearance bring nirvana. He went as far as that. Patience and forbearance. And remember, the word yama also means forbearance. Very interesting. Patient endurance. Now, a patient endurance is a loving endurance. If it is a truly loving endurance, one is never hurt in the process of the enduring. One may be hurt circumstantially. a wife or a husband or a son or your business partner who squanders what you have worked at assiduously and built up, or breaks it down or something. You endure that patiently. All right, let's put the pieces together again. I saw this exemplified in my own father in relation to me. He would advise me, say, if you do this, there'll be trouble. And I would do it, and something would break or etc. No, never mind. Let's put it together again, if we can. If we can't, we have to get a new one. But it was only after I left the parental home and came to this country, in retrospect, I saw this in its reality. Underneath are the everlasting arms. It was absolutely marvelous. One who never hurt me. Never. And it's something which one never forgets. Patient endurance, he typified. So if there is this loving endurance, one doesn't endure in the spirit, I've got to put up with it. Or rationalize it by saying, I have to be patient with him and wait and wait and wait until the thing comes right. Which means until what I think is the right thing will come about. That's all wrong. Loving endurance, a togetherness, an upholding. There is such beauty and loveliness in the whole thing, this patient endurance. And you see, if one is able to release patient endurance into life, there is always a smile in your heart. And the right sort of smile. The next one, that is the seventh, and the next one, the eighth, is they usually translate this word, dhriti, as firmness of mind in gain or loss. I prefer to use the word steadiness instead of firmness. Steadiness of mind in gain or loss. You see how it is in the world. We believe in being firm. The element of rigidity, the element of opposition and conflict is there. But you can be completely resilient, elastic, and be steady all the time. Whether you are experiencing a gain or whether you are experiencing a loss. This is a different thing, isn't it? It's the steadiness of the mind in gain or loss. Therefore, one never gets into a flap about anything. And one never tumbles down the stairs with elation because you have won $500,000 on the pools. Steadiness of mind. It's a balanced state, not a static balance, a rigid condition. It's a plastic, dynamic, flowing condition, responding to the situation, therefore, in the right way. See, we think we understand the meanings of the virtues. We don't. There is so much in any one of them. You'll spend a whole life growing. Next, Mitahara. Mitahara. Eating in moderation. I won't say any more about that. I've already said enough during the previous days. But perhaps it may be interesting to mention what one of the Upanishads, yes, the Yoga Tattva Upanishad says, scanty eating is the most important yama. And harmlessness is the most important religious observance. So now you've had it out of the yogi's mouth. The Yoga Tattva is one of the many Yoga Upanishads, as they are called. Then, lastly, number 10, Shaucha, cleanliness of body and mind. I think we considered that in some detail. We considered that in detail, was it yesterday or day before? Well, one of the 2 days. So I didn't say any more. There is one very important matter to add. The Upanishads, in fact all the religions, present these in their threefold form, in thought, speech, and action. All these virtues apply and must be practiced. If you were to contemplate quietly upon the implications of these, in terms of the mind, take for example truthfulness in mind, in thought and in feeling. An enormous amount will evolve out of that. Truthfulness in thought and in feeling. It's extremely difficult. The psychological part is very much more elusive, very much more difficult than the purely physical part. We can practice truthfulness in speech and understand what that means reasonably well. But truthfulness in thought and feeling is something which is very difficult. And its implications are enormous. So bear that in mind.